Hello, my name is Craig Barton and welcome to the Tips for Teachers podcast, the show that helps you supercharge your teaching one idea at a time. This episode, I had the pleasure of speaking to English teacher and author Mark Roberts, and this is a great one. Four quick things before we start. Firstly, sponsor slots for the podcast are open, so if you want to let the world's most interesting listeners know about your book, product or event, just drop me an email. Number two, you can view videos of all Mark's tips on the Tips for Teachers website. These videos are great to share in a departmental meeting or training session. Number three, you can sign up to the Tips for Teachers newsletter to receive a tip in your inbox most Monday mornings to try out with your classes in the coming week. And finally, and this is probably the most important one for me on a selfish level, if you find the podcast useful, please could you take a moment to review it on your podcast player of choice? It really does make a difference. Thanks so much. Okay, back to the show. Let's get learning with today's guest, the wonderful Mark Roberts. Spoiler alert, here are Mark's five tips. Tip one, use post-it notes to find out what they don't understand. Tip two, use non-verbal gestures for better behavior management. Number three, don't give negative managerial feedback. Tip four, stop talking about grades. And tip five, rephrase to amaze. It's a really good one, this, you know. If you look at the episode description on your podcast player or visit the episode page on tipsforteachers.co.uk, you'll see I've timestamped each of these tips so you can jump straight to anyone you want to listen to first or re-listen. Enjoy the show. Well, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Mark Roberts to the Tips for Teachers podcast. Hello, Mark. How are you?
I'm fine, Greg. Good evening. It's good to speak to you.
Good to speak to you too. For the benefit of listeners, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, ideally in a sentence?
Yeah, so I currently work at Carrickfergus Grammar School in Northern Ireland. I'm the country's first director of research, and I also teach English as well.
Amazing. Right, well, I'll tell you what, let's dive straight in. What's your first tip you've got for us today?
So, my first tip is to make sure that you use post-it notes to find out what they don't understand. Now, this is specifically a particular time in your curriculum sequence, and I use these post-it notes in the lead-up to assessments. And the reason I do this, I'll explain first of all what I used to do and then why I do what I do and how it works in practice. But what I used to do is say to students, does anybody have any questions about this assessment that we've got coming up? And sure enough, you know, one or two students would put their hands up because I've since realised that asking students any questions is just about the most pointless question that you can ask. And there's actually research that's been done into students, their response when you ask them any questions, and they don't answer because they're worried that if they put their hand up and say, I don't understand this, that they're going to look stupid in front of their peers. So I wanted to get around this, and it took me a little bit of time to cotton on to the fact that they did have questions, they just weren't going to publicly admit them. And I tried different things where I'd go around and ask each table, you know, can anybody tell me one thing they're worried about? And that wasn't working either. So one day I just said, okay, I've had enough of this. Gave them all a post-it note, anonymously. I want you to write down, every single person has to write down one thing about the upcoming assessment that they're worried about, that they don't understand, that they'd like me to come over, go over again. It can be anything at all. There's no stupid questions. Everybody's got to do one. And then what they do, they come and stick them on the board whenever they're done. And what I do in the lesson, if I can cover them, or if not in the next one or two lessons, I go through these post-it notes and I answer them one by one. Well, I say one by one. Actually, what you find is that tends to be patterns where students usually have the same kind of worries, the same kind of misconceptions, the same kind of things that I've not taught effectively or not explained carefully. And I start to group them together and we'll start to answer them within topics. And one thing that's particularly helpful, it gives me immediate feedback in terms of areas that I need to cover rather than just asking them generally what they think. And secondly, I think it's really reassuring for students to know that actually they're usually worried about the same kind of things and that they're not this anomaly where they're stupid and they've struggled with something. And that is something that has brought about from students saying, no, nothing that I want to ask, to having something from every single person in the class.
Whoa, I love this. I absolutely love this. Right, so one kind of observation and one question for you here, Mark.
Yeah.
So the observation is, I completely agree with you with this. Anybody got any questions? I used to ask that for years and years and years. And I'll tell you the mistake I made. I assumed that silence was a signal of understanding. So if nobody said anything, I just assume everyone must get it. But of course, it's the complete opposite. If people aren't saying anything, it's either that they're, as you say, too scared, they don't want to be embarrassed in front of their peers, or sometimes they've such a lack of understanding that they can't even formulate exactly what it is they want to ask the question about. So yeah, getting rid of, has anybody got any questions? That's been a big improvement in my teaching. So I love that. But here's my question for you. Whenever I use diagnostic questions and I say to students, okay, 3, 2, 1, show me your answers, and they vote A, B, C, D, what you often get is like a tactical delay where you'll get some kids who just wait that extra second just to check what their mates have done, and then they'll either swap their answer to match that, or they'll stick with their answer if a lot of other people have gone for it. I'm just wondering, even though you anonymize the post-it notes, do you get that some kids just want to wait a little bit until a few post-it notes are on the board? Is there a way that you just ensure that even with this strategy you've got, that students are still kind of open and willing to share their questions, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it's a fair point. I think that the beauty of sticking them on the board, even students who sat really nearby can't actually read what are on the other students' post-it notes. So there's less that sense of, I'll just put what they put. And also, I get them to do it right at the start of the lesson, usually when I'm doing my retrieval practice. And it's very much individually, in silence, and I'll go around and just make sure that that's not happening. So I usually get questions from all students, and there's usually a range even within the same topics. And some of them are really, really basic questions, such as, can you tell me how long the assessment is? What do we do if we can't remember a quotation, or things like this? Whereas others would be particularly specific and technical. You keep mentioning this one particular word, can you give me a definition of it again, because I'm still struggling with it? So you get a whole range of questions, I just find it particularly useful, and I've not had any kind of pushback or complaints about it. It's something that they all just go along with now.
I love it. Right, Mark, what is tip number two, please?
So tip number two is to use non-verbal gestures for better behaviour management.
Ooh, tell me more. You've intrigued me straight away here.
I'm going to give you 7 reasons why I think students respond much better to non-verbal gestures rather than being told explicitly. And I think that this is something that I've posted about before, I've tweeted about this, and it's gathered a real lot of attention. And for me, it's something that I just always assumed was a bit of a no-brainer, that the less that you have to talk as a teacher, it is a good thing. So the first thing is that it saves your voice. And I know, as we're coming towards the end of the year, that's a really important thing as a teacher. I know when I get to this stage of the year, I start to get increasingly croaky. So on a very practical level, just putting your finger to your lips instead of having to say, can you please be quiet, is saving your vocal cords. The second thing is it stops you from disrupting the flow of your explanations, or if you're reading aloud or something. So say, for example, today I was reading to my Year 8 class, noticed that a couple of students were just having a tiny little off-task little giggle at each other, very low-key, but I could kind of give them the signal, look down at your thing, and I could carry on reading at the same time. So it's really seamless, and it stops me from having to add that kind of cognitive load of stopping the rest of the class to tell someone off. The other thing is that it doesn't draw attention to those particular students. If I'd have said the two students' names, be quiet, immediately it brings attention to them. And some students like that attention because it brings them the kind of kudos of the social rewards of being shown that you're messing around. So it takes away the opportunity to do that. Which also, the next reason is, it avoids any kind of conflict. You know, you're always picking on me, you're always saying I'm doing stuff wrong. And I know there's a few students that I teach that if I said to them, can you stop doing that, it would immediately get their backs up. But if I just kind of give them a look, or if I kind of point to say sit down or something like that, immediately it reduces that sense of confrontation. Now the other thing is, and I think this is massive for teachers, is it's proactive, it's preventative. So rather than allowing things to escalate and get into the stage where I've got to start giving out warnings and demerits and so on, it enables me to do something in a way that's nipping something in the bud without really anybody else noticing immediately. And that, the next part of that, is that it really can reduce your stress levels. You can be really calm by not having to raise your voice. You might kind of raise the intensity of your stare when you give them that look, things like that. But it's something that a lot of the research that I've read around teacher well-being shows that proactive gestures can really cut out this sense of stress and anxiety that we feel when we get into that kind of conflict situation. And the final reason is that these signals are pretty much universally understood. So there's not really that issue around, am I saying something in a potentially sarcastic tone? Have I said something that comes across as a bit snappy? Instead, if I turn my fingers around like that to say sit down, it's obvious what I'm saying, and they all understand it. So yeah, 7 reasons why you should use those nonverbals.
I love it. I love anything like this. These little kind of micro tips and tips within tips. I absolutely love this. Right up my street, this. So again, same thing. Kind of one observation here. The flow thing isn't something I'd considered before, but you're absolutely right. There is nothing worse than when you're mid-flow through an explanation or a student's given a response and then you have to stop because somebody's messing around and then you've then got to try and reset and think where you're at, and you know you've lost a load of the kids, and oh, it's so annoying. So this non-verbal, I absolutely love that. Now, the thing I was going to say is, so I record these interviews, we put these out as an audio podcast, and we also chop them up as videos and put them as videos. I'm always trying to push more people to the video, so this is a perfect opportunity. Give us some of the best gestures here, Mark. So this is, for the benefit of the podcast listeners, you're going to have to watch the video on this. What are some of the big hitters? So you've done the kind of turn around. I like that, yeah.
Shush is obviously well known. You've also got the kind of settle down.
Oh, gesture. That's good. Yeah, I like it.
You should be reading now.
Oh, nice.
You should be writing now. You've also got the kind of the finger wag. should not be doing that. And then also you can do the kind of like referee get a move on signal.
Yes.
Come here. Those kind of things. So yeah, so that's the ones that kind of come to mind. And then of course the classic, the teacher stare.
I love it. I absolutely love those. So podcast listeners will have to hop on the video to see the full range of those. I also love, just a final point here, Mark, the fact that it almost, again, I'd never considered this before till you've just mentioned it, the fact that you can be more consistent with these non-verbal ones, because there's not that change in the either the tone of your voice, the pitch, the volume of your voice. So you can, I mean, we're always told with behavior that consistency is a really important thing. You deliver these signals in the same way to every single child. So it's not the case that sometimes you're a bit more tired, you're in a bad mood yourself, so you lose it a bit more. It's always the same. That feels like it's a really important part of this.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Right, Mark, what is tip number 3?
Okay, this next one's a little bit bigger. So when you're giving feedback, don't give negative managerial feedback. Now, I'm going to have to explain that term. It's a term that I first came across in the work of Carolyn Morgan. 2001, this study came out. And she defines negative managerial feedback as feedback that is obsessed with task completion, presentation, those kind of study habits, rather than necessarily the work itself. And the reason I became really interested in it is that she found in her research that boys are far more likely to get that kind of feedback, whereas girls are far more likely to get feedback that improves them as learners. So the kind of thing that you often see with written feedback, you should have finished this. Why aren't all the boxes filled in? I expect more detail for this. This is too scruffy. You need to use pencil instead of pen. Those kinds of things. I've even seen, is this it? Written on books. And my answer to that is, well, clearly, obviously, it is it. Because they'd have done more if it wasn't. But those kinds of things. Now, I'm not saying that presentation's not important, and I'm not saying that productivity is not important. But when we obsess with how much boxes have been filled in, rather than looking at the actual quality of the work and what they've done that could be improved and getting down to the nitty-gritty of the success criteria, when we do that, we're sending out these messages that say, we care more about whether boxes are filled in rather than you thinking hard. And I know that Mary Myatt speaks and writes about this really eloquently, as you would expect. And it's something that I see frequently that teachers are doing. And when teachers say, well, yeah, I want to control their presentation, I don't want it to be sloppy and so on, I say, well, you can have those kind of conversations, but don't make that the main feature of your feedback. Don't make it the only thing that you pick out on. If you've bothered to sit down and mark their books, or you've bothered to give them verbal feedback, and all you're talking about is those kinds of things, you're creating this really negative relationship, whilst at the same time you're not really helping them know what they need to do to get better. And this research shows that it leads, with students who get this kind of feedback, it leads to them enjoying activities less, they lose confidence in their own ability, and they do also start to dislike the teacher. So there's various reasons why you shouldn't do it, but I think it's something that teachers often fall into the trap of doing this. You know, they're frustrated. They've marked 17 books and they keep on seeing this same kind of trend. They're frustrated and they kind of take it out on the ink. And that's something that I think we need to really reconsider.
Well, this is a good one. You've got me thinking again here, Mark. I love this. So the first thing that springs to mind, I don't think I've done one of these interviews yet where I haven't referenced Dylan William. I always like when he says about feedback that it should improve the learner, not the work, not the specific task. And this feels kind of right up the street of that. Second thing to say is, I've been guilty of all these, Mark, because it's so easy to give that kind of feedback, isn't it? Because it's very visual, isn't it? Like, if you see a scruffy piece of work, it's the first thing you notice is that it's scruffy. Or if you've given some rule, like you've always got to underline whatever, it's so easy to spot that hasn't been done. So I've definitely been guilty of all this. I find it fascinating that the research suggests that it's given to boys more than girls. It's one of those things, it now doesn't surprise me that you've said it, because I'm thinking that's exactly what I'm doing when I'm giving feedback to boys. So this is terrible. So my big question for you is, and it's a bit of an unfair question, but I've got to ask it. So if you've got someone in your class who is really, really, their work is really scruffy, it's really poorly presented, and the thing is, we know that their work, like, there's some good stuff in their work, but we also know that if they produce that kind of work in an exam, they're going to do well to get a lot of the marks, because the examiner's not going to take the time to read it perhaps that we would do, and so on and so forth. How do we help that child improve their presentation? Because my go-to would be to write those kind of things on their work, but now I realize that's not a good idea.
So let's say a student's work is genuinely illegible. That is a massive issue and we can't leave that. We have to do something about that. So I'm not necessarily talking about students who you just can't understand it. That's a real problem and that has to be tackled. But we're talking, you know, scruffy is different to illegible. And if it's something that it's indicative of a kind of poor attitude towards their work and not really paying attention and so on, rather than the fact that they've not got particularly neat habits. You know, my exercise books were never particularly neat. My handwriting's pretty ropey. But if it is something where you think this is an issue, what I'll do is, when I'm giving my feedback to them, and usually I do this verbally, I'm not a big fan of marking, I'll talk to them about their work, I'll talk to them about things that I want them to improve on, real areas that they can develop. And then often, a bit later, usually on the way out, I'll have a quick word with them. I'll just say, you know, one other thing I want you to think about is just to, you know, look at the state of your book and just show to me that you really care about it and just smarten up a bit with your efforts. And I think that because I've spent a lot of time giving them that helpful feedback, they're far more likely to take it on board.
Absolutely. Final one just on this, Mark. Now, if anybody was sad enough to listen to these and do a drinking game at the same time, mini whiteboards will be a good thing to have a shot to because it comes up every single conversation. I'm thinking here that I visit quite a lot of high-performing schools that aren't particularly bothered about students' exercise books. Now, I'm talking from a maths perspective here, because they realise that the way to get good at maths is just to do maths. And if you're spending 10 minutes trying to set a question out really neatly versus 10 minutes answering five questions, as long as they're legible, as you say, you're better off doing the latter. I just wonder whether mini whiteboards, another potential benefit of them here, is for those students who are a bit scruffy, one, it encourages them to write a little bit bigger. Two, you don't have that permanence that is like scruffy work in their book that's always there. You know, it doesn't matter if you're scruffy in the mini whiteboard, hold it up and now we can rub it off. What's your view on that?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And I think that the question you're asking there is kind of what are our exercise books for?
Yeah.
If they're there, that it's just there to allow you to do lots of practice and to, you know, to write down the answers to your retrieval practice and things like that, that's fine. But I suppose that we're hopeful that they're going to be really useful when it comes to revision as well, when it comes to them using them for study skills. And I suppose this is where the presentation side of it comes into it, and people think, okay, well, if they take really effective, neat notes, they're far more likely to use them. I think that there's a bit of both, isn't there? I think that you, on the one hand, you don't want them to obsess about everything being neat and underlined carefully and spending hours on that. But on the other hand, you would like to think that there are certain parts, at the very least, where they're using Cornell notes and so on, and that they're going to be really effective bases for their study. So I think a bit of both, to be honest. But yeah, there's certainly no reason why you can't make greater use of the mini whiteboards as a way to get away from this obsession.
Just one bonus question on this, Mark. I love speaking to non-mathematicians about this. So my theory or my view on maths exercise books is that kids never ever use them for revision. Like once they've been used in the lesson, forget it. Because it's so hard for two reasons. One, it's so hard to find what, you know, in your exercise book what you want to revise. It's often kind of scattered all over the place. But two, that it's very hard to, well, it's quite a poor technique to revise math simply by rereading, you know, your notes or whatever. Yeah. You want to really be doing it. And it's quite hard to quiz yourself using an exercise book. How does it work in English? Like, do kids genuinely use their exercise books and classwork to revise in an effective way?
I think certain parts they do. So say, for example, we watch a documentary that enables you to have context into the background of one of the novels that you're studying, and you get them to take notes using the Cornell Notes format. And that's something that then can be put onto flashcards and they can use them as part of their revision. One other thing that I strongly encourage my students to do is if we write practice paragraphs in lessons and they do a really good practice paragraph, or maybe they write down my model paragraph or something like that, I then ask them to try to memorize chunks of that to use in the exam. So they might use bits of it that are going to go onto flashcards, or that they might use them to incorporate them into new practice essays. So I think there is a little bit more of a sense that they are useful springboards for revision.
Got it. Fantastic. Okay, Mark, tip number four, please.
Okay, it's funny you mentioned Dylan William, because I'm going to mention him in this next one. And it's about teaching in the classroom, trying to stop talking about grades wherever possible. And I think there's various reasons for this one. We'll go back to the classic William and Black 1998, or the black box stuff, where if you stick grades on marking, we know that they don't focus on the actual feedback. And we know that it can lead to them avoiding trickier work in future. And there's all of the kind of issues around them settling for the expected grades, the minimum grades, those kind of things. And I think that's something that a lot of teachers probably understand, that if we keep saying to a student, you know, if you work on this, it will change it from a grade 3 to a grade 4, it might limit them to thinking only about just getting a grade 4. But I think that there's deeper issues with it as well. And it comes down to all of ideas around intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. And I think that the more that we talk about grades, which are really these external factors, this idea of passing grades, getting a certain grade, passing exams to get something out of it. You know, you get a place onto sixth form to do A-levels, or you might get some kind of reward from your parents if you do particularly well, or you might see that it's a kind of a stepping stone to a particular career where you're going to be well paid, or all these kinds of things. Or it might be that you get the recognition of doing really well and you get one over your peers and so on. And all these kind of external, extrinsic factors. The research, particularly around boys, shows that it's not a healthy type of motivation to have. And that students who are intrinsically motivated, the fact that they study and they learn for the joy of knowing more about their topic and becoming more knowledgeable and being more skilled at a particular subject, that's far more likely to lead to long-term academic success. So I think that if we keep on going in our feedback, going on about grades and going on about mark schemes and going on about mark bands and so on, we're falling into this trap of encouraging students to have these extrinsic motivations rather than the more intrinsic. If you develop this, you're going to become an even more skilled mathematician, that kind of thing.
Another biggie, this one, flipping heck. Right, okay, yeah. So a few things on this. So the first is, yeah, I won't name the particular school, but one school I worked at, the policy was that all the kids, as soon as they got a new exercise book, at the front of the book, a big, I'm talking on the cover here, their big target grade, so whether it was A or 6 or something like that. And you're absolutely right. The problem was, for some kids, like that target grade for a start was based on SATs scores, and they'd had a tutor for the SATs and they were never going to get it in a million years. So they were so far away from it that it was no motivation whatsoever. And as you say, other kids would just settle on that and think, well, I've got that in a particular assignment, so let's just ease off for the rest of the year. So yeah, definitely see that a lot. Now, when I was writing my first book, I tried to get my head around all the literature on rewards and extrinsic and entry. It's a flipping nightmare, Mark. I found it really confusing. So one of the things I picked up on is that whilst intrinsic motivation is obviously the dream that we've got to go to, sometimes you perhaps need a bit of extrinsic motivation to kind of kickstart this kind of virtuous cycle where you then put a bit more effort in, you find out you're doing a bit better, you enjoy the subject a bit more, so you put a bit more effort in and so on. Well, would you buy into this? Do grades play a role in that in any way? Like if a kid's like not doing much work and you say, look, you're in danger of failing here, but if you put a bit of effort in, oh, well, now you've improved it by 2 grades. Does that play any role in the short term, do you think, at all?
No, I'm not convinced. I appreciate that the kind of dichotomy between extrinsic and intrinsic motivation, it's not that simple, and that we all have certain elements of extrinsic factors that motivate us and so on. You know, obviously we go to work because we're paid, but we stay in jobs in the long run because we get the satisfaction out of the job. We feel valued. So yes, there may be these kind of little short-term influences, but I'm convinced that taking grades out of your conversation in the classroom really reduces that, not just the intrinsic motivation for students, reduces their concern about extrinsic factors. It also takes a bit of pressure off them, and there's not this sense of constantly having to think about the exams all the time. And when students will say to me, you know, what's my target grade or stuff like that, I'll say what you mentioned. You know, I can go on the computer if you want and I can have a look, and it'll tell me what you should be getting based on what the computer thinks you were like at 11. We can do that if you want. I don't think that's going to be particularly useful, but we can do that if you want. And I always say to them, if you do what I've asked you to do, and if you keep working on these particular areas, the grades and exams will take care of themselves. So let's not get bogged down by worrying about that. As far as I'm concerned, we're going to work on becoming better at English, and over time, anything can happen. And I just think that this is something that we start to limit students ourselves as well. If at the start of the year you go on and have a look at all your classes' target grades, you start to think, okay, well, okay, so he's going to be a B. And I once saw a teacher do this, actually. Again, I won't name schools or anything, but I once saw a teacher at the start of year 10, set out all the rows of students. So my grade fours are at the front, my grade fives are next, and so on. And I was like, why are you doing that? Oh, well, it enables me to get round and offer them more kind of precise differentiation. No. And I said, all right, so you've decided what they're going to get right at the start of the year in a two-year course. Oh, yeah, I'd not thought of it like that. So I just think that it influences us, it influences students, and whilst there may be some short-term boost out of it, in the long run, those kind of performance goals, those kind of performance targets don't help them. It makes students lose confidence, it makes students feel as if they're going to be found out in the long run, and it makes them more likely to avoid complex tasks. Where if we just say, okay, let's not worry about grades, let's just worry about becoming better at this, and we'll see what happens.
Right, okay, let me push it a little bit on this one. Now, I will say, okay, for the record, I'm almost entirely on board with you here. But let me just ask you two things. So the first thing, just on a practical level, if you mark an assignment or maybe even a mock exam or whatever, do you put a grade on that, or is it just a mark? And could you argue the mark has the same impact as the grade, or are they different?
Yeah. There's certain times when you this is unavoidable. So absolutely, when it comes to these big assessments, where at my school, we, at Key Stage 3, we use a percentage out of 100. We balance that up against the average score within the year group and so on, so that they parents get an understanding and students get an understanding of where they are, roughly. And when we get to GCSEs and we do mock exams, yes, we give them a percentage and we give them a grade. And that's unavoidable. It's something they have to do. But I notice as soon as I give back the papers for them to look back at the feedback, what did they do first of all? They look at the grades and they all share. What did you get? What did you get? What did you get? And I want to reduce that as much as possible. I want to take that out of the equation as much as possible. So whilst I have to do that a few times a year, the rest of the time, I'm not going to play that game.
Right. Okay. Last point on this one before I hand over for your final tip. What about, let's picture this scene. What about you've got a kid, and I've taught a few of these, and maybe you have too, who is genuinely motivated by grades and getting better. You know, you've got this kid who perhaps, you know, they've done an assessment or whatever, they're on a grade 6, and they say, you know what, I really want to get this grade 9, so I'm going to keep working hard, and you're saying, okay, we'll keep working hard, but I'm not kind of going to tell you where you're at and so on. Could you think that there is an argument to be made that grades can be intrinsically motivating or not?
So I see in those kind of circumstances, a student who's aiming for the very top, you're not going to limit them in any kind of way. I would say, okay, well, this is what you need to do to be trying to present the best possible essay, the best possible answer, the best possible story. Is this going to get a grade 9? I'm not sure. I think that if you put all these things together, it would probably get that. But it's something that is out of your control. And, you know, the old cliche about controlling the controllables, you know, worrying about, am I going to get this grade 9? We know as teachers that only about 2.5% nationally get it. And I've taught lots of students who've got it, so I'm not saying it's something that's out of reach. But I suppose that I'd try to reframe it and just say, listen, you want to get a really, really good mark for this. That's absolutely fine. I'm going to show you how to do it. You do this. Let's see what happens. And I just think, again, you can minimise it whilst at the same time not dampening down their motivations.
Yes. And I guess the same
I'm never going to...
Yeah. Well, sorry, Mark, I was just going to say, I guess the same thing would apply. You've got a kid who they really want that grade 5 because it's going to open some doors or something like that. I guess it would be the same argument, right? That, you know, it's let's not focus on the grade 5. Let's focus on doing all the work and then hopefully it'll take care of itself. Would that be the message?
Yeah, it is. I'm just thinking of a student who's just sat his GCSEs for me. And I know that we do modular in Northern Ireland still. So they did some exams in November. And in the lead up to the exams, he kept saying, I'll be happy with a C, mate. If I can get a C in English, I'm sorted. And I got a little bit cross with him, only for the benefit of the rest of the group, and just saying, I won't be. I think you're capable of doing really well. And I don't want to see anyone settling for less and just, you know, being comfortable and coasting. And he got his modules, and in one of the exams, one of the units, he got an A. And I said to him, I made a point of saying to him afterwards, you know, that's why I wasn't happy with a C for you. And he saw that, and that's something that I think can be a really valuable lesson for them. And yeah, we ended up talking about grades in that occasion, but it was one of the reasons why we fall into this trap earlier on. We start to limit them.
Jeez, that would have been some story if you'd have ended up getting a D at the end of that. But luckily, we went out. All right, Mark, what's tip number five, please?
Okay, so tip number five is my little kind of one of my little favourite sayings when I'm talking to teachers about the kinds of things that you can do to boost students' confidence is rephrase to amaze. So rephrase to amaze is my little catchphrase for when you're questioning students and a student gives you a response, and this response is correct but very basic. So it's lacking, say, in technical terminology, it's lacking in detail, it's lacking impressive vocab, something like that. And what you do is you rephrase it and you add in the technical terminology, you add in the extra detail, you add in a bit more impressive vocab, and guess what? Their answer is suddenly really impressive. It's really impressive because you've done a lot to embellish it and to make it sound amazing. Now, that is something that I think some teachers do that already, and that's fine. But the thing that I do that I think is something that other teachers might find particularly useful is you don't just leave it there. You come back to this answer at some point, either in the lesson or preferably in future lessons, where you say, you know, you remember the other day when we had that amazing answer about how volcanoes erupt? And you remember how we looked at the concept of this and we used this particular word and so on. And the student who's given this answer is motivated because they've given this amazing answer. And the other students start to look to them as this kind of resident volcanologist, this resident expert within the classroom. And it's a little bit of a cheat. It's something that you're orchestrating it a little bit, and it might not be for the teaching purists, but I found that this is a really good way to switch on demotivated students. And I'd never do it with an incorrect answer. If it's incorrect, I'm going to say no, because that would be wrong and that wouldn't be helpful. But if it's a correct but basic answer, yeah, go to town with it and make it sound brilliant.
All right, this is interesting. So let me see if I've got my head around this. So yeah. Is it the case that, so a student gives a correct but basic answer, and do you say then rephrase to amaze and then they do the work, or do you support them with a rephrase? And how does it work, Mark?
I just rephrase it. So say I say to a student, why do we think that Dr. Jekyll has created Mr. Hyde? And they come back with a basic answer. Oh, well, he wants to be able to get away with doing things he wouldn't be able to get away with otherwise. And I say, yeah, absolutely. So what we're looking at there, what you're telling me, is this idea of duality and the idea that Dr. Jekyll is being able to have this kind of facade of the respectable gentleman, but secretly he's indulging in all these secret vices. And then later on, a couple of lessons later, you remember having the conversation the other day where Stephen gave us this answer about duality and the repressed Victorian gentleman. Let's think about that again now and stuff like that. So that's how I tend to do it.
Oh, this, I'll tell you what, we could be ending on a controversial note here, Mark, because we need a bit of conflict here. This might, I'm not 100% I agree with this. I'll make my case and then you come back at me here. Okay. So I can completely see it from a motivational point of view. I can completely see how for some kids, and probably most kids, that'd be a really powerful experience. And I'd never thought to do the coming back, you know, the next lesson. That feels like something really powerful. Yeah. My fear is that the child will think they've understood that concept to the level that they need to because you've kind of reframed it. And I think like Doug Lamov would call this rounding up, where they've given an answer, but you've then kind of added the key ingredients that make it a real sophisticated answer. And my fear would be that child thinks, oh, brilliant, I understand that, amazing. So I can almost kind of stop thinking about that now. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you kind of say, all right, great answer, but you're not quite there, you need to, can you think what else you need to add? Maybe then the kind of extra effort goes in to get it up there. What would you say to that?
Yeah, you'd need to check for understanding to make sure that this is something. It's not just you kind of pontificating and showing off and it not actually going through. So I would then be looking at examples of work, modelling, using these kind of ideas, checking that students are using this kind of language, making that a real focus of some of the work, and going back and just checking that it's embedded. Because yeah, there's no point having these fancy debates, discussions, throwing words around like confetti unless they're actually being used there in exercise books and you're seeing real evidence of it. So I might say, okay, well, let's go back to this idea. I think that we're still not quite grasping actually what this concept is about. You know, Stephen gave us this really good example of it, but let's just have a look at it in a bit more detail and really break down exactly what's going on here. And I think that you would have to do that. You can't just expect that because you've said something fancy, they're automatically just going to take it in. But it's a first step in getting them feeling successful about themselves within English, which is going to motivate them to want to do more of it.
It's really interesting. It's one of these things I'm going to need to think a bit harder about this because it's kind of what it's the trade-off, isn't it? The motivation is such a powerful thing. And I can imagine for some kids, that's exactly what they need. But then I can also possibly see the flip side where they kind of the message they take from that is, well, I've actually given that answer. So what the teacher said, that's kind of what I said. So, you know, I've got that understanding. So I'll just need to think that through. My final thing on this, though, Mark, this is something I've been thinking about myself at the moment. And I'd just be interested to get your take on this. I've done when I first started my career, I was really lazy in the sense that I would. So I'm talking maths here. I would set the kids a load of questions, but I would never work out all the answers myself before the lesson because I'd think I'm a decent mathematician. I'll just wing it in the lesson. It'll be fine. And that was terrible because I lost a load of time in lessons and sometimes a really bad question had snuck in there and then not the kids' confidence and so on. When I got a bit better, I always would work out all the kind of written problems that I would give the kids and that was fine. But one thing I never did, and I've only started doing this recently, and it seems to tie into what you're saying there, is if I was asking kind of a question where the kids were going to give a verbal response, I would never think to kind of script out like an ideal answer, like the answer that I really want them to do. Because again, I'd think, well, I'll just make it up on the spot. But what I've started to realize now is that if I don't kind of map that out, I can forget it. Like I get so lost in trying to listen to what the child's saying. There's a million other things going on in the lesson that actually, when I then do what you're doing, the rephrase to amaze or whatever it may be, I never get it as good as I should have done because I haven't written it down. So would you be kind of writing these things down? Would that be something that would be something that you'd kind of advocate for these questions just so you kind of guarantee that you're going to get that explanation the way you intend it, if that makes sense?
I tend not to do in this situation. It tends to be a little bit more ad-libbed, really, depending on what it is that they say. But I think that when you're talking about things like modelling really effective answers, I suppose in maths you'd be looking at worked examples a bit more. I will often think very carefully, and sometimes I will write out one in advance. And then other times I will just do one off the top of my head because I want them to see me edit and struggle and make mistakes and give them the insight into how my mind works as a writer. So I think there's pros and cons with these, and I think you have to think about the stage that the class is at. To begin with, I want them to have like a perfectly polished answer that's at a level that they can immediately find useful as a model. Once we get a bit more beyond that, I want them to see me struggle and think on my feet a little bit more, particularly if I'm doing something like an exam question against the clock. But when it comes to the kind of rephrase to amaze stuff, no, I tend to just come up with these off the top of my head. And some of them will probably be better than others. And if some of them aren't great, I might forget about them. If some of them are particularly impressive, I might get them to write down something on the board. I often say, oh, I like that. I'll write that one down. You know, wasn't that a good thing that I just came up with? But with students, I'd kind of, I like that idea. We're going to write that one down and make it seem as if the student's done it as well. So these things can be captured another way, I suppose.
Fantastic. Well, I'll tell you what, Mark, they were five absolutely brilliant tips. I've loads to think of there. So let me just hand it back to you. What should our listeners check out? What should they need to be looking at that you've been working on?
So if you're more interested in reading my work around boys, my most recent book that came out in June last year is The Boy Question, How to Teach Boys to Succeed in School. That's available via the Routledge website or on Amazon if you prefer. Before that, I co-authored Boys Don't Try, which came out in 2019. Loads of people have got that already. And then if you are more interested about my writing as an English teacher, I released a couple of years ago, worst timing ever because it was slap bang in the middle of no exams, a guide to how to revise in English, which is called You Can't Revise for GCSE English, Yes You Can, and Mark Roberts shows you how, snappy title. And then I did a follow-up version of that, which was the A-level literature version of them. And despite the timing fiasco with the exams there, it has actually been very successful because lots of students are buying it now, but also lots of English teachers have bought it because it's really helped them with little tips and techniques, the kind of things that I've been mentioning here today. So those are things that you might want to check out, and of course feel free to follow me on Twitter at Mr_EnglishTeach.
Fantastic. Well, I'm going to put links to all the work and your Twitter on the show notes page so listeners can check that out. Final thing I'll say just before we wrap things up. I remember it was a Research Ed National, and it was, I don't know how many years ago this must have been. I'm assuming it's pre-COVID, but my sense of time's gone completely. And you and Matt were doing one of your Boys Don't Try sessions, and I don't know what Tom Bennett was thinking, but he put you on in some like little classroom or something. And I arrived, I must have been 15 minutes early because I was desperate. Absolutely, I got the book and I was desperate to hear. I got loads of questions for you. And they were queuing outside. It was absolutely pandemonium. So I couldn't get in to watch you. So that's why I've been desperate to get you on the show to get some of those insights and ask some of those questions. So Mark Roberts, this has been absolutely brilliant speaking to you. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much, Greg.